Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash on I-10 eastbound at the State Route 202 that has the left lanes blocked. Also on the 101 northbound at Broadway, a crash there has the shoulder blocked. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Slight chance we could see some more rain. Look for a high of 95. We topped out yesterday at 101. It'll be clear tonight. Overnight lows in the low to mid 80s. Slight chance of rain continuing. Sunny skies, no mention of rain for tomorrow with a high of 103. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 91 degrees. Supporters of legalizing recreational marijuana in Arizona have kicked off their Yes on Prop 205 campaign. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, the Arizona Secretary of State is set to announce later this afternoon it's gathered enough signatures to put the issue on the November ballot.
Advocates of the Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol campaign gathered to talk about why. They included a local doctor, a former Drug Enforcement Administration agent, and Lisa Olson, a mother of five with multiple sclerosis, who says marijuana has helped her shed all her MS drugs. While she uses pot medicinally, she thinks it should be available to all adults.
It's a gentle, loving plant that has healing properties, and I never would have believed it had I not walked through my own life experience that brought me to this place. I probably would have been on the side of Bill Montgomery.
She's talking about the Maricopa County attorney, who's one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit trying to keep recreational pot off the November ballot. The case is set to go before a Maricopa County Superior Court judge Friday. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The issue of legalizing marijuana is also the subject of a two-day conference being put on today and tomorrow by ASU's Morrison Institute. It includes pro and con arguments, as well as presentations by independent experts. One of them is Brad Rowe. He's president and managing director of Botech Analysis. It's a research and policy consulting firm. His company has worked on this issue. And Brad, assuming Arizona's measure makes it to the ballot, survives the legal challenge, and then voters approve it, what does the implementation of a legal marijuana policy look like?
Well, implementation of the legalization of marijuana is it's a very political process and one that is fraught with all kinds of claims and challenges from both sides. I mean, what we can say, and we did, Botech Analysis worked with helping the state of Washington, the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, figure out how to implement the legalization of marijuana there. And they had a lot of very specific concerns that we worked on for them in the most dispassionate way. So if there's one thing I can encourage people to do is to try to take as dispassionate, as analytic an approach as to how the legalization of marijuana will affect them and go where the data takes us.
What were some of the concerns that folks in Washington had that they asked you to help them with?
The state of Washington was a little more forward-thinking than I think most states were. They really wanted to be very analytical. They wanted to collect a lot of data. They wanted to research all of the components of legalization. So we helped them out looking at testing for contaminants in cannabis, testing for psychoactive agents, sampling cannabis for analytical purposes, modeling marijuana businesses, identifying regulations, looking at cannabis testing labs, economies of scale and production, like a whole battery of different things. What we ended up doing is really looking at all of the concerns that they were anticipating that they would have. And I think it allowed them to, in a much more methodical way, roll out the legalization of marijuana for the state of Washington. And I think probably helped them get ahead of some of the issues that they were concerned about.
Based on your work with Washington and your observations in other states, are there lessons that you see from those other places that if Arizona goes ahead and enacts this and rolls this program out, that things that happen in other states that maybe we could learn from so they don't happen here?
Yeah, my main piece of advice would be to get it in writing. If you really think that tax revenues from cannabis sales are going to go towards, you know, prevention programs and reducing adolescent use or cannabis use disorder, or trying to educate the public on how to get treatment if you need it. Make sure that that's in the documents that you're supporting in these initiatives. And these are mostly initiatives. If you're trying to support some kind of a legislative effort toward the legalization, make sure that your representatives are taking into account things that are important to you, and really look at the most recent research. We're just trying to make sure that people are thinking about this in the most methodical way that they can, and that they're really looking after the concerns that they might have for their families or for their workplace or for their community if they happen to be a community leader.
Brad Rowe is president and managing director of Botech Analysis, a research and policy consulting firm. Arizona is doing well in four policy areas in the fight against cancer. That's according to a new report from the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The annual study also finds Arizona making some progress in three areas and falling short in three others. Joining me to break down the results is Brian Hummel. He is the Arizona Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And Brian, what do you make of how Arizona's doing?
Well, we have room for improvement. We have made some really strong successes that have impacted literally tens of thousands of lives in Arizona for the better, where we increased access to Medicaid and access to specific drugs that help cancer patients, medications like oral chemotherapy. And from way back, 10 years ago, where we passed a strong smoke-free law and increased our tobacco tax to $2, so we're still above the national average. Those are all very good things that we've done, but we have room for improvement.
I think for a lot of these state rankings, it's almost like a competition to see who can do better than the other. It seems like in this one, maybe it's not so much. It's like it would be great if everybody was just doing terrifically.
Oh, for sure. So in Arizona, cancer is the number one cause of death. Almost 12,000 people will die from cancer this year in Arizona, and more than 32,000 people will be diagnosed with cancer. About half of those cancers are preventable. We know the things that can work that can save pain and suffering for literally thousands of people every year, and some of that is through policy.
How much of the policy that deals with cancer prevention, cancer treatment, how much of that is done in general on the state level versus on the federal level?
It's a pretty strong mix. There are things that definitely can be done at the state level. Usually it takes a little bit longer for things to happen at the federal level. So our work, the work that I specifically do, is focused here in Arizona to ensure that Arizonans have access to quality care, especially Arizona cancer patients and cancer caregivers, that they have less stress when they go through their cancer journey.
In the report, there were a few categories in which Arizona was deemed to be falling short, including a tobacco control program funding and a palliative care. What can groups like yours do to try to bring those categories up to where some of the other ones are?
Sure. Tobacco prevention and cessation program funding, $1 million, which to most of us sounds like a lot of money, but in the overall scheme of things in the state budget is not. $1 million would move us from the red category to the yellow category. That would put us over the 25% of the CDC recommended level.
Which would mean the state's making some progress.
Yeah, and it also means we know that those programs work. I mean, so that's the key part of all. We know that each of these programs that we're talking about that we rate, we know that this works. Our palliative care legislation that we propose, that we offer from the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, is very simple and straightforward. It asks for an assessment of what is offered in the state and then makes recommendations so that we can look at who has access to palliative care and who needs access to palliative care, what regions of the state, and it's pretty simple and straightforward. It doesn't cost the state any money at all.
Of the things that Arizona has either been making some progress on or needs to make more progress on, are there any that in the next legislative session are going to be a particular priority to your group?
Sure. working on palliative care legislation to do that assessment that we know that needs to be done, look where there are gaps. We are going to ask for additional funding for tobacco, and we're going to make another run at tanning to prevent minors from using indoor tanning devices.
Brian Hommel is the Arizona Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We'll post a link to the report we were talking about at theshow.kjzz.org. Americans are using a lot more natural gas than we used to, and that could pose a climate problem, according to the Environmental Defense Fund. 4 years ago, the EDF partnered with Google Earth Outreach to find out just how big that potential problem is. They're using Google Street View cars to locate and map methane leaking from natural gas lines in cities nationwide, and Mesa is one of the most recent cities to be mapped. The show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on that. And Lauren, what prompted this project?
As a country, we've been doing a lot more natural gas extraction using fracking and other techniques. So I talked to Mary Gady about this. She's working with the EDF on this project. And she says utilities are required to monitor their distribution pipes that look for leaks for safety. But the EDF wanted to understand the climate implications of it.
The utilities have always looked at the leaks in terms of safety, which makes total sense. But because of our focus on climate, we were interested in how much actual methane was releasing, the quantity. We wanted to understand what kind of leaks there were, what the size of those leaks were, and then try and come up with technology and information that will help utilities repair those leaks more quickly.
Lauren, what are the climate problems associated with this leaking gas?
So methane is the primary component of natural gas, and it's a greenhouse gas, just like carbon dioxide. So Gady says when it leaks from natural gas pipes, it has a warming effect that's 84 times stronger than carbon dioxide over a 20-year time frame.
Scientists think that some 25% of the global warming we're currently experiencing is actually caused by methane right now. So it's really important that in terms of the climate, we manage to look at the leaks that are putting out the most in terms of quantity of natural gas and have utilities, once they've taken care of the safety considerations, address those leaks first, which means repairing them faster or replacing pipelines that have the leaks.
Are you talking about really big leaks like what's been happening in California up until recently, or are we talking about things that are much harder to detect?
You're referencing the Aliso Canyon leak from their huge storage reservoir, but we're talking about just the pipes that are underneath city streets. Utilities are required to and routinely patrol them and monitor them, looking for leaks. And then, as I said, if there's a safety hazard, they repair them immediately. But leaks that are smaller and don't pose a safety hazard can often go unfixed for actually years and years and years. And that poses a climate problem, but it's also an expense of just wasted gas going up into the atmosphere that people are paying for.
So you recently looked at what Mesa has been doing and tried to map these leaks in Mesa. How did they do?
It looks really good. It's a good system and it's well maintained. We mapped about 200 miles of Mesa. We looked at the central, west central, and southwest central parts of the city. And in the course of doing that, collected over 600,000 data points and found only three what we consider low-tier leaks. So it comes out to a ratio of about one leak for every 60 miles we drove, and that's really excellent. We have mapped in other cities with older, more aging infrastructure like Boston or New York City and found one leak for every mile. Here it's one leak for every 60.
I'm sure you're kind of partway through this study, but what in general are you finding? How big is this problem?
Well, the problem is, as I said, fairly big, and it's not surprising. It's we're corroborating, I think, that which we sort of understood going into it, which is that in cities with older, leakier systems, with cast iron, unprotected steel, that you're finding more leaks. And that's why there's no surprise that we found these kind of leaks in Boston or in New York City, in which they have a much more aging infrastructure. But the other thing that's been really interesting is just finding out sort of the quantity of gas that can escape from these leaks, how that adds up in terms of climate impact, and recognizing that even though they may not pose a safety concern, it's really imperative that they're addressed in terms of climate impacts.
And as Mesa was recently mapped, I also talked to Lyndon Boltz. He's the Energy Resources Compliance Administrator there. And he says they could only confirm one of the three small leaks that the EDF identified, and that one was repaired immediately.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Looking for a job with a future in high tech in a sunny spot like Reno, Nevada? Then you may want to check out the factory being built near Reno. Tesla's manufacturing facility for batteries and cars is to bring jobs back to the U.S. to make all electric cars exotic and affordable. It'll be the largest factory in the world, and whether that scares BMW or not, BMW wouldn't mention their enemy in this ad, noting the long Tesla delivery times.
You will do your taxes twice, maybe more. You will ring in the new year twice, maybe more. You will wait and wait and wait some more, all before that electric car company's new model ever even arrives.
Tesla delivered 50,000 cars in 2015, but needs enough rechargeable lithium-ion batteries to power 500,000 cars by 2020. And they've partnered with Panasonic to build that $5 billion factory in the Nevada desert just east of Reno. Joseph Taylor is chairman and CEO of Panasonic North America. He says among the challenges is recruiting and hiring tens of thousands of employees to operate this plant 24/7.
There has never been a factory this big. It's called the Gigafactory. It will have the largest factory footprint of any factory in the world, not just battery factories. If I recall correctly, it's around 5 million square feet, the size of 130 football fields or three Central Parks in New York City. It's huge.
And the production will produce batteries for how many cars per year, do you think?
So at full capacity, it will create enough batteries. We rate it on gigawatts. This will create 35 gigawatts worth of energy. It's a huge factory, but it still won't be enough to provide the batteries for all of the cars that Tesla is hoping to build annually. We'll still use our factories in Japan as well as a factory we're building in China.
Have you driven a Tesla?
I have. We had the first S series because we are by far the largest and I think most important partner to Tesla. We had one of the first S series that were produced and we're enjoying one of the first X series SUVs as well.
When you press the accelerator on a Tesla, what is it that tells you those batteries are working? What kind of muscle do those batteries provide that a combustion engine doesn't?
Well, the first way you know the batteries are involved is the muscle that's involved is your neck, because it snaps back into the seat when you accelerate. You've never seen such acceleration or performance in a car. I don't need any gauge to tell me it's working pretty well.
So what are the challenges that go along with manufacturing batteries on such a huge scale as is envisioned in Nevada?
When you look at all of the issues facing us, the single biggest challenge we're facing today is how do we find thousands of workers to run the factory and continue the design of the batteries in a really short amount of time.
So to train people, I mean, is it a lack of training people in America or something different?
I think it's a combination of things. It's not just trained workers, because we can train people to work in the factories, but it's skill sets involved as well as the number of people we need. So when you look at this Gigafactory and you combine our requirements with Tesla's requirements at full capacity, we'll employ combined approximately 6,500 workers. And even in the short term, we're looking at thousands of workers to run not only the machines in the factories, but the engineers and the procurement people and the other professional services, and to find and hire and train literally thousands of workers in that short amount of time has really become the single biggest challenge that both ourselves and Tesla are faced in the short term.
Joseph M. Taylor is chairman and CEO of Panasonic North America.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. The New York Times has unveiled a Spanish-language version of its news app. It's available now for Android-based users. The app includes all of the paper's original Spanish-language stories, as well as several pieces translated from the Times' English edition. To get a sense of where this new edition will fit in the Spanish-language news universe, I'm joined by Rick Edmonds. He's the media business analyst at the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit journalism school. And Rick, what do you make of the Times' new effort here?
Well, I see it as steps in a progression. I think their efforts to distribute their journalism in Spanish format date back for a while, maybe a year or two. And I would see adding an app as a way to particularly target that segment of the audience that is going to consume the information on a smartphone and do it in a maximum-friendly way.
Are news consumers fickle enough to try something like this from the Times, from a news organization that they have probably heard of, and maybe move away from a news medium that they already use?
Well, I'm not sure it's either or. I think users, particularly given the reputation of the New York Times, can be tempted to sample the work and see how they like it. And of course, like many organizations, the Times wants to do kind of a progression where you become aware of them and you see a bit of what they do, and then if you like it, you may move up to being some kind of subscriber.
Where do you think that this app will fit in the universe of Spanish language news media?
Well, I think it's probably particularly for readers who have kind of an international curiosity as opposed to what's going on in their hometowns and their home countries. And perhaps also a particular interest in the United States. And of course, the sort of the big idea here is that it may open access to people who are not proficient English readers and speakers, and therefore you can be exploring a new audience and maybe a younger audience as well.
So do you foresee this as maybe more geared toward people in Spanish-speaking countries as opposed to those already in the U.S.?
I do think that's the primary goal, and the New York Times has been very clear that over a period of several years, they expect to get a lot of their growth from the international markets and have been doing a whole variety of things to promote that. But, I do think also a side benefit is that it's available to that segment of the U.S. population that would really prefer to read in Spanish.
For those readers already in the U.S., do you think the Times Spanish language app will be able to compete with things like Univision and Telemundo and La Voz and all the other Spanish language media that's already here?
Well, I think that's a good question and a fair question, and I've been doing this long enough to remember a wave of activity maybe 10 or more years ago where a lot of companies, and I'm thinking not necessarily of the Times, but regional chains and so forth, decided to get into the so-called ethnic media business, and there were several efforts in Spanish, and they were only moderately successful. And I do think that one can sort of underestimate the degree, especially in a sort of a community setting, where an established organization and might have multi-generational management has really sort of embedded itself and gets that community in a way that others don't. Then again, the New York Times is competing more at the national, international level, but you raise a good point. There's Univision and an assortment of other things, and it's really not the case that everybody wants a sort of a text-first version of the news, so those outlets do well.
How do you think the Times will and maybe should define success?
Well, I think their standard definition is that they want to grow, particularly grow digital-only subscriptions. So, yes, it gets at that reach, and I think it's fairly clear that they see that as a best opportunity for growth.
Rick Edmonds is the media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. Rick, thank you very much.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks.
You're listening to the show on 91.5, and these are the sounds of the city.
2, 4, 2, 5, 2, 6, 2, 7, 2, 8, 2, 9, 30.
Hello, my name is Chastity Williams, and I work for Quest Civil Constructors, and I'm here to get certified in first aid, AED, and CPR.
So shout, tap, shout.
Okay, shout.
Are you
Okay.
You know, this is a prime time for heat stress, and, you know, someone could have a heat stroke and then go down, and then myself or my supervisor could be the person there to help them.
Lower left on the rib cage. Perfect placement.
Everyone stand clear.
Stand clear. All right, here we go.
I just think about, you know, that's someone's dad, someone's brother, and I want to be able to save their life so they can be there for their family.
9, 10, 12, 13. All right, keep going. No stop for the AED.
I'm a safety engineer. That's what I do, and that's what I want to do, preserve human life.
And start firing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's Chastity Williams getting her CPR certification at the American Red Cross. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. You might want to set your alarm a bit early tomorrow morning, like maybe between midnight and dawn, and find a nice dark spot to look up at the sky to get a glimpse of the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. Joining me with the what's, where's, and how's is Kevin Schindler, the historian at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. And Kevin, first off, what is the Perseid meteor shower?
Well, we have, you know, on any given night, you can go outside and see a shooting star. You know, a flash of light going across the sky. And the shooting star is the same thing as a falling star. It's the same thing as a meteor. It's just when a piece of debris from space enters into the Earth's atmosphere, it's moving at a really fast speed, and it burns up in the atmosphere and creates that streak of light. So on any given night, you might see one of these or a few of these. There's a lot of junk out there in space floating around. But meteor showers are times when you have concentrated numbers of meteors. The Perseid meteor shower is generally one of the better ones because you might get 40, 50 meteors per hour on average every year, and that's pretty good. But this year, it's going to even be better because, well, we think it might be better. I should hedge that. Because, you know, out in our solar system, we have a bully out there, Jupiter. And Jupiter is the largest planet. You could fit 1,000 Earths inside of it. And it's so large and so massive that its gravity tugs on other stuff in the solar system. So when you have small particles, like a cloud of particles from these comets, these meteor streams, Jupiter sometimes will, its gravity will push or pull that cloud in its orbit. And so this year, Jupiter is doing this to where it's kind of pushing the cloud of debris a little bit, to where a greater concentration will intersect with Earth.
Are these visible without telescopes? Like, can you just go outside and see them?
Well, yeah, that's the great thing about meteor showers. You don't need any special equipment. In fact, it's better not to try to catch anything through a telescope because, you know, it's just a quick streak of light. And so you would have to be, it's not like you see it across the sky then can focus a telescope on it because it would be, it's already gone. So the best way to observe them is just to find a dark area and, you know, find a nice, easy chair to, you know, lounge chair, lay back and look up at the sky.
What do these look like? Like if I'm in my lounge chair sitting out in an empty, dark field somewhere, what am I going to see?
Sure. Well, in general, the majority of them will be just really quick streaks of light. And, you know, it's almost a lot of times, you know, you see one out of the corner of your eye, and by the time you look over at it, it's gone. So they don't last very long. And I should point out that most of these things, what you're seeing is a particle burning up in the Earth's atmosphere, and usually it's within about 60 miles or so of you. So it's not, they're not that high up really. But the majority of them are just a particle the size of a grain of sand burning up. They're just moving so fast that they create that streak. Now, if you get bigger pieces, sometimes you'll get an even brighter or bigger one. Those are sometimes called like bolides, where they're really bright meteors. Sometimes you'll see colors, you know, like a green, and that's because of what the particle is made of. But in general, you're just going to see a really quick streak of light. As a comparison, sometimes you can go outside at night and you'll see, you know, if you see a blinking light moving across the sky, that's an airplane. If you see a light that's steady, slowly moving across the sky and stays there for, you know, more than a few moments, that's probably a satellite. But if you see just this really quick streak of light, that's going to be a meteor.
Kevin Schindler is the historian at the Lowell Observatory. We're talking about the Perseid meteor shower. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Tourism is one of Arizona's most important industries, and there are lots of marketing campaigns to try to bring tourists to different parts of the state. But two East Valley cities have formed their own partnership. Chandler and Tempe each put up about $60,000 this year for the Sunny Arizona campaign, which consists of a website and advertising in AAA publications, among other efforts. With me to talk about this are Michael Martin, the Executive Vice President of the Tempe Tourism Office, and Kimberly James, Chandler's Tourism Development Coordinator. And Kimberly, let me start with you on this. What's in it for Chandler to be part of a partnership with Tempe?
Well, I think what's really important about our region is a lot of people are looking to the greater Phoenix area, and it allows our two cities that are very complementary in their attractions to kind of leverage our resources. A lot of people don't know when they're coming into Chandler that they're leaving and going into Tempe or vice versa all the time. And so I think we can present our communities as one single destination, and we can get in front of more people, more advertising, more exposure, so we can bring more folks out.
Do you find that visitors to the Valley sort of know what Chandler is? I mean, I think people have a sense with Tempe that ASU is there, so they at least know that there's a university. What do people know about Chandler to the extent that they know it?
Sure. I think for a lot of people, they think of it as a business climate initially, of course, but they also think of it as being very new. Of course, the downtown Chandler has really become very well known for its independent restaurants, the Crown Plaza San Marcos Resort being there. So there's a bit of a reputation there, but I think most visitors know it coming to Chandler as a traveler, business traveler first. But we're hoping to kind of dive into more of the leisure travel and try and bring more visitors. They're coming out visiting family and friends and just kind of general awareness.
Michael, what's in it for Tempe? I mean, why is it a good partnership to be with Chandler?
I think it's great because, as Kimberly mentioned, we were very complementary to one another. And so, you know, in Tempe, we're more of an urban destination. We're a college town. We have Arizona Mills, which is the outlet type of shopping. We have IKEA. But what Chandler provides is the additional upscale shopping at Chandler Fashion Center. So it's nice to have that kind of product. Something that we can help promote, because as Kimberly said, if you're in Tempe, you go across the border to Chandler, you don't really know you're crossing the border. And so if we can share each other's attractions, things that I have that she might not have, and things that she has that I might not have, we can promote them together and create hopefully a longer stay that people will come and want to stay, you know, instead of 2 days, maybe 3 days.
You've each mentioned the fact that when visitors come here, they often don't know that they're crossing city lines. And I think a lot of residents don't necessarily know when they're driving from Tempe to Chandler or Chandler to Gilbert, sure, something like that. Do you find that this effort that you have a website up, you have a marketing campaign, does it bring people to Valley cities other than just yours? I mean, do people come and maybe go to Scottsdale or Phoenix or Gilbert?
Yeah, I would say that it's very usual for people to be in one town but then travel through the rest of the city. I mean, the reality is that if you're staying in downtown Tempe, for example, you're probably going to go on the light rail to downtown Phoenix to the Herd or to the Phoenix Art Museum, or you'll drive up the road to the galleries in Scottsdale. We know that and we accept that, and actually we encourage it, because the longer a person can stay, the more impact they're going to have. So if they have more experiences to see or into experience, then the longer they're going to stay. And our goal, of course, overall is room nights. We want people to stay in our hotels, get that extra night. If it's two nights stay, we want it to be a third night stay.
Kimberly, have you found that since this campaign started that your tourism has gone up?
I think so. I mean, you look at back in 2009, we had a nearly 50% increase in our room night inventory in Chandler. And as we approach January this year, we're going to increase our room inventory another 22%. So I don't think all those hotels would be developing if that business wasn't in existence. Unfortunately, it's a hard thing to always track, especially when you're looking at leisure travelers. But the input we're getting from our hoteliers has been very positive.
How does this effort between your two cities fit in with other tourism efforts? Tourism is obviously a very big part of the state's economy. There are valley-wide efforts. There are statewide efforts. Where does this fit in?
I think our marketing program is pretty unique. I mean, there are different regions in Arizona that will partner from time to time, but this program has been in place for a number of years, and it's been long running. And sometimes we see these programs that other communities will do, and they pop up for a couple years, or they're very short-lived. I think ours is a little different because it is so long. I mean, initially it started with just the Midwest, but there's been opportunities where we've looked at the Pacific Northwest or California and kind of modified based on what our traveling behaviors were that we were trying to target. So I think the biggest thing about it is just being adaptable to what's happening.
Do you find that other Valley cities are jealous, upset, like wish that they would be a part of this, or wish that the two of you weren't sort of like forming your own alliance here to do this, that they feel maybe left out in any way? Michael, you're shaking your head.
No, not at all. I think that every city knows what they need to go after to make themselves successful. And so in the past, we've always left the door open for anybody to join in our co-op together. And it's just, you know, all the markets in the Valley, they just go after something different, which is fine. And I think it's actually a positive thing because it allows us to focus on a niche market that is going to drive people to Arizona anyway. And Scottsdale may benefit from our promotion. Phoenix will. Tucson might. And that's okay because on the back end, we know that when they're doing their programs out of state, somehow, some way, Tempe and Chandler will also be affected. You know, all ships will rise together. And so if you look at the international market, for example, the Office of Tourism might be doing something in Germany. Well, Phoenix and Scottsdale typically are there, and that's great. We're not. And that's fine with us because we know that if they're going to bring those international travelers in, somehow, some way, we'll have a positive effect on our end.
Michael and Kimberly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Martin is Executive Vice President of the Tempe Tourism Office. We also heard from Kimberly Janes. She's Chandler's Tourism Development Coordinator.
Arizona State Parks is kicking off a new project called the Arizona Premier Trail System. This comes in time for the 60th anniversary of the state parks, which is next year. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry is here with more about this new trail system and what it means.
I talked with Glenn Schlottman with the State Parks Department, and he said they're still in the process of having parks nominated for the designation and that it's really meant to showcase trails that are of a certain quality.
So what we put together is a criteria for trails, and saying that we're going to hold trails to a certain standard to be in this program. And then we're going to promote that system to the public as these are the best of the best trails in Arizona. Go out, you'll be able to find the trailhead, you'll be able to navigate the trail well, you'll see the most stunning scenery while you're out there, you'll find these unique places. So while there's thousands of trails in Arizona, we're holding these to a whole new standard.
So what are some of the criteria you look for when you're thinking about which trails meet that standard?
So there's a committee, the Arizona State Committee on Trails, that put together, with public input, criteria for all the trails. And so essentially it's holding them to this new standard. And, you know, do you have a trailhead? Is there unique qualities about the trail? Is there a historic relevance to the trail? And then within that, there's actually 7 different categories for a trail. So it's everything from a recreation trail to a historic trail, a scenic trail, even water trails are included in this list. And each one of those categories has its own unique criteria specific to that user group.
I think one of the problems that hikers have seen in Arizona, particularly maybe over the last like 5 or 10 years, is that there have been these trails that have been kind of spectacular trails that people, they may even be hard to get to, but people know about them. And so they start frequenting them. And they become overused, or people might not be taking care of them the way they should be. And then that trail is no longer maybe in great shape. For example, I keep thinking about Fossil Creek, which was this beautiful trail that went to this beautiful pool of water. And then it became very popular, very overused. It got littered. People were bringing beer bottles into there.
Right.
And it became very difficult. And now you actually need a permit to use it. Is there any concern that putting some gorgeous, pristine trails with beautiful scenery on the list might kind of cause one of those problems?
When we're putting together this list, that was one of the key things we were thinking about. How do we make sure that it's still a beautiful place for people to go? And that's where the nomination process going through land managers comes in. So if the National Parks feels like a trail, its promotion through the Arizona Premier Trail System would not be great for that trail, they're not going to nominate it. So we're going to only have those trails that can take the increased use. The other thing, too, is there are those trails that get a lot of use. But when we start talking about these 100 great trails, now we have so many more options for people who were just always using the same trail and maybe overusing that trail. Now they're spread out across the state. And then once a trail gets designated as an Arizona Premier Trail, it's reviewed on an ongoing basis. So just because they're in the program, if that trail isn't maintained to the quality, they won't remain in the program. So it's all about getting that standard and adhering to that standard.
What are some of the trails that you maybe personally frequent the most or think are some of the greatest trails that are part of the Arizona park system?
There's so many great trails. I have a lot that I like throughout the state. There is one I have to mention just because Sabino Canyon. It's this trail down in Tucson. It's highly managed. It's an amazing resource for people. And it's actually the trail that I took my wife on and asked her to marry me. So I'm biased on that trail. But
that's Glenn Schlottman of the Arizona State Parks Department. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
If you think of all the big medal winners in the Olympics, the U.S., Russia, and China all come to mind. But there's another large country that rarely gets to the podium. India has the worst Olympics medals record in terms of population. Despite having the world's second largest population, India has yet to win a single medal in Rio. In 2012 in London, India won only 6 medals and no golds. That works out as 1 medal for every 200 million people, and that's the best it's ever done. The BBC's Justin Rowlett has been exploring why India is so bad at the Olympic Games.
Duti Chand is the fastest woman in India and one of the country's best hopes for a medal in the most competitive of all Olympic disciplines, athletics.
We have never won a medal for running, but with God's grace, I will get to the finals and I will win one.
And best of luck to her. But compare India's performance with minnows like Grenada and Jamaica. They regularly get a medal for every couple of 100,000 people. The UK, meanwhile, averages a medal for every million or so. India, 1 medal for every 200 million people. So why isn't India punching its weight? Shiva Keshavan's training regime is terrifying. He competes in the luge event in the Winter Games. It's a kind of super fast sledge. But because there are no luge tracks in India, he has to practice on the open road, reaching speeds of almost 100 kilometers an hour. Yes, whizzing past the traffic and everything.
Yeah, it is. It is dangerous.
Like many Indian athletes, Shiva complains he just doesn't have the money he needs for equipment and training.
When I was training for the Olympic Games in 2014, I didn't have the money to go to Sochi. And one of these articles went viral online, and an online currency portal picked it up. And within a few hours, they did this online fundraising for me without me even knowing it. And they called me saying that, hey, we'd like to help you out. So yeah, these kind of things happen. I've been blessed to have a lot of people who supported me in this way. But I still think that to be sustainable, you know, we have to have a proper system in which how the funding, how the athletes are selected, how they're trained from a young age. So that still needs to come up.
India's Olympic Association admits the country hasn't always done enough to support its athletes. Its head, Narayana Ramachandran, says the country is poor and sport is rarely at the top of anyone's agenda, including athletes' families.
Sports has always taken a back seat vis-a-vis education. People, families tend to give their children more education. The view is to, you know, concentrate on education than on sport. Because the basic feeling is that sport doesn't bring in the money that is required to run a family.
And resources aren't the only issue.
The caste system is also one of the reasons why India hasn't done well in sport.
Professor Ronojoy Sen has written a book on the history of sport in India.
We must remember that the lower castes constitute a bulk of India's population, and these lower castes are also the ones who are really the ones who don't have access to education, don't have access to good nutrition, health, which has meant that a large part of India's population hasn't been able to take part in sport.
But private companies are stepping in to try and improve India's performance at the Games, funding athletes, many like the runner Dutti Chand, are from the lowest castes. Manish Bahuguna runs Anglian Medal Hunt.
What we bring to the table for these athletes is the ability to bridge that gap between those best practices which are unavailable to them otherwise and the final performance at the Olympic Games. That's what we bring to the table. We improve their conditioning, physical and mental, by leaps and bounds.
Relax. Shoulders relaxed.
India will have its biggest ever team at the Games in Rio. The world's second most populous country is hoping that Dutti and the other athletes will help it raise its game this time round.
That's the BBC's Justin Rowlett. Soccer fans are out in force in Phoenix to watch the U.S. women's team compete in Rio. The team has won gold in the past three Olympics. The show's Annika Klein talked with some fans hoping for another triumph.
If you haven't been keeping up with soccer in the Games, here's a recap.
Our men's team actually didn't qualify for the Olympics, so that was kind of a dagger.
It was tough for soccer fans like Tyson Gill to see the U.S. men's team lose their qualifying games and miss out on Rio. But Gill and other fans are gladly cheering on the women's team at a watch party at Tilted Kilt Pub in Phoenix. And though the women are all the way in Rio, there's a feeling of connection to the players.
Julie Johnson, she went to Dobson High School, which is here in Arizona, and I actually went to that school. So it's cool to cheer her on because I know that she went to my high school.
And there are some new players to get to know better. In the second half, 18-year-old Mallory Pugh scores a goal to bring the team to a 2-1 lead.
They're winning their games. They've won two games, and this is their third game in their bracket.
Nicole Leschek says she's been watching the team year-round since she was a little girl.
Rapinoe is my favorite player.
Today they're taking on Team Colombia in their last game before the quarterfinals. Leschek and her friend Maggie Goldenberger are snacking on nachos and fries with their eyes glued to the large screen at the front of the restaurant. Goldenberger says she's more of a casual fan, but she feels it's important to support women's teams in general.
Like in college, I played sports, and so I'd always support all the other women's teams. It'd always be the men got a lot more support, and I feel like the same thing just continues on.
But not so much with this soccer team. Sports Media Watch reports nearly 3.6 million viewers tuned into NBCSN for Tuesday's game against Colombia, topping all of the team's 2012 Olympic ratings except for the final game. The women's team is entering this Olympics on the heels of a World Cup win last year, making them an even bigger force to cheer for.
Everyone's out to get us.
That's Ryan Shira. He runs the Phoenix chapter of American Outlaws, a national movement to drum up a soccer fandom in the U.S.
So we're like the big 800-pound gorilla that everyone's trying to take down, and that's kind of different for Americans in soccer.
The American Outlaws are about 500 members strong in Phoenix. They organize watch parties like the one at Tilted Kilt. Shira says getting together to cheer the national team is a fun way to watch, but it's also a way to grow the sport at home.
We have a lot of young daughters who come out and watch, and they're usually the ones that are heavily involved. They're playing on club teams or they're playing in youth programs, and it's important for them to see, oh my gosh, look at all this support for a sport that I play. And I think that's very empowering.
And it goes towards goal, and it's in! A magnificent goal!
A goal by Colombia in the final minutes of the game had fans on the edge of their seats. The 2-2 draw wasn't what they were hoping for, but it sure made for exciting viewing. And it might rally more support on the home front for the team's quarterfinal match against Sweden tomorrow. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.